The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Book of Serenity. Magu shakes his staff. The pointer. Point into a deer, making it out to be a horse, picking up earth and turning it to gold, rousing wind and thunder on the tongue, hiding a bloody sword between the eyebrows, sitting there watching success and failure, standing there examining life and death. Tell me, what state is this? The koan. Magu, ringed staff in hand, came to Zhang Jing. He circled the meditation seat three times, shook his staff once, and stood there at attention. Zhang Jing said, "Right, right." Magu also went to Nanquan, circled the meditation seat three times, shook his staff, and stood there at attention. Nanquan said, "Wrong, wrong." Magu said, "Zhang Jing said right. Why do you say wrong?" Nanquan said, "Zhajing is right. It's you who's wrong. This is something that can be blown by the power of the wind. It inevitably disintegrates." Hongzhi's poem. Right and wrong, watch out for the trap. Seeming to put down, seeming to uphold. It's hard to tell who's the elder brother, who the younger. Conceding, he adapts to the time. Denying, what's special to me? One shake of the metal staff, standing out all alone, three times around the seat, a leisurely romp. The monastery's agitated, right and wrong are born. It seems like they are seeing ghosts in front of their skulls. So this week we've had Don and some of the other instructors here teaching Kyudo all week, the way of the bow. Been so good to have you all back after a couple of years of not. Couldn't do that online quite. And so at the beginning of the week, as I was thinking about this talk today, this Taisho, the phrase hitting the target came to my mind, knowing that there's much more to Kyudo than that. Striking the mark, going to the source. I saw Bodhidharma facing the wall. To the one who sees, the mind is a mirror, and the world appears before it and is reflected. This is an image that's been used for hundreds and hundreds of years, thousands of years in Buddhism. There is an image that appears on the mirror. The mirror perfectly reflects. That's the capacity of our natural mind. But the image doesn't enter into the mirror. But without the image, it wouldn't appear. Without the object in front of the mirror, the image wouldn't appear. So there is a relationship, but the object does not enter into the mirror. To the one who sees, the world is a mirror. The mind appears and is reflected in everything that stands before us. Which of these is right? Which of these is wrong? Is there a road beyond this? Beyond right and wrong, that doesn't forsake right and wrong. Magu was a disciple of Master Matsu, who is one of the kind of luminous figures in 8th century Chan. He had a multitude of disciples, many, many disciples. So he was prolific, and Magu was one of them. Zhang Jing, the other character in the koan, is another, as well as Nanquan. So these are all Dharma siblings. And there's an interesting story where one day Magu and Nanquan, his Dharma brother, and another monastic were traveling to Mount Jing. And on their way, they encountered an old woman who was a shopkeeper. So this is a little hearkening to the koan I spoke on recently about the old woman of Taishan, serving tea on the road to Mount Taishan. And so they stopped and asked her, what's the way to Mount Jing? And she said, just go straight ahead. Magu said, is there water ahead that is too deep to pass through? And the old woman said, it won't even soak your feet. Magu said, the rice paddy on the upper terrace is good. The rice paddy down below is withered. The old woman said, it's all been eaten by crabs. Magu said, but the grain is fragrant. The old woman said, there's no scent at all. And then Magu said, where do you live? And she said, right here. So then they all went into the woman's shop, and she boiled a pot of tea and set out three cups. And then she said, if you masters have a pervasive spiritual knowledge, then drink some tea. So what do they do? Do they have pervasive spiritual knowledge? And so they all looked at each other in surprise, and then the old woman said, look at this old crone, show her pervasive spirit. She grabbed the cups, knocked over the teapot, and left. Well done, I'd say. So Magu comes to Zhang Jing. It doesn't say anything about timing. It's when Zhang Jing must have been teaching. It seems like it would have been when Magu was still training because of just this whole event. And so he came. Was he coming to seek the teachings? Was he wanting to clarify his own understanding? Was he seeking approval? Carrying a ring staff, and this is a traditional staff that had 12 metal rings at the top. And the 12 rings represent the 12 links of the dependent origination. So that as they walked, and the ring shook, it was a constant reminder of how things come into being. In the Buddhist teaching of dependent origination, which is one of the most profound teachings of Buddhism. And also perhaps that ringing would alert any critters or animals that might be threatening that they were coming. So he comes in, he circles the meditation. Normally there would be a very formal way of entering, a way of paying one's respect, offering incense, making bows. Here he just walks right in, circles the seat three times, shakes the staff, and then stands there at attention. So for the student working on this koan, the first point is, what is Magu presenting? What is he expressing? What is he communicating here? What is his understanding? And so the koan, the student essentially has to encounter the mind of Magu within that action and see what Magu has seen. The footnote to that says, he sure has a whole lot of chan. I was just thinking about my brother who was a Sikh, practicing the Sikh tradition for many, many years, decades. And in the early years, he once expressed concern because they don't shave their hair. They don't cut their hair because that's part of their spiritual practice. And he expressed concern before my ordination that I was going to shave my head. He said he didn't think that was a very good idea. And I said, well, it's kind of not none of your business. Not your call. And their tradition they spoke of as being having the qualities of happy, healthy, and holy. And I expressed my concern about this holy part. Seemed like a whole lot of holiness and where that can lead. So Dada Roshi used to talk about the stink of Zen, that when we cling, we grasp to a sense of spirituality or sense of holiness, of religiousness, of wisdom, of anything, but particularly in the spiritual vein, that it has a particular quality, right, that he spoke of as a kind of a bad smell. And so the footnote says he has a whole lot of chan, right, coming in and presenting this way. We all have Buddha nature. We all have the essential nature of the Buddha, the nature that we all share, that we have in common. It's not a sharing kind of thing, right? It's not like you have some and I have some and trees have some and bridges have some. It's just one nature. It's like the ocean. The ocean isn't divided into quadrants. We can create all kinds of ideas of boundaries, ownership, and so on within an ocean, but the ocean has none of that, knows none of that, needs none of that. So having a Buddha nature, this one nature, that's all the same. We practice, we realize, to liberate ourselves from everything that obscures that, not just the trust in that or the understanding of that, but the direct experience. And in our practice and development, evolution, we might say, nothing changes. Inherently, nothing changes, intrinsically. We don't become a different person. That's part of the idea that we need to shake off, that we need to sort of see through. It's not about that. That isn't needed, not in that way. And so in that way, when we practice, when we develop along the way, when we have realization, when we transform our lives, in a way, that's nothing special, right? That's what's supposed to happen. That's why we're here. That's what has been passed down, is that very natural, ordinary liberation. And at the very same moment, what is happening is a brilliant, radiant jewel is being revealed. And that's extraordinary. When it becomes something, when it's something we wear on our chest, our sleeve, we hold in front of us, it's, as the old teachers said, it's like having gold dust, which is this precious, lustrous mineral, and you throw it in somebody's eyes and now you blinded them, right? It's not precious anymore, it's painful. And so there's a lot of training, a lot of practice that is about bringing forth realization. It's like bringing out this jewel, this extraordinary nature that we have, and really bringing it out so that we realize it's not special. It doesn't create a difference between an enlightened being and a deluded being. Those are just words. They're necessary words. The Buddha said they're conventional designations, so we can talk about our current state, our deluded state, and recognize it and examine it. And then we can talk about enlightenment, right, as something that we aspire to and realize. But to not become confused by those words, as though they are pointing to something that exists absolute, and that in enlightenment something is elevated and distinguished. And so what is Magu presenting? And the commentary says, this is the supreme state. All states arise from this. So he's saying, Magu is presenting something that's actually very important, very profound. He just comes in and stands. He doesn't speak. He doesn't perform. He's just there. What is that? Because he is where he is, just as we are where we are in every moment. The circling and the shaking of the rings, that was not necessary. He could have just come in and stood. He could have not even come in and stood. So what is that? What is Buddha nature? What is that which is not increased or decreased, that which we are carrying with us in every moment? Why do we practice mindfulness? Why do we develop our concentration? Why do we do meditation? Why do all of those essential aspects of practice, what do they bring us to? You know, no one has ever come to enlightenment or has let go or has freed themselves of any single thing yesterday. And they have never done it tomorrow. It has only and can only happen here, as she said, right here. There is no other place that we are. And yet we can spend our whole lives not knowing that, never being right here and never being anywhere else. And that's the power of our mind, right? Our confused mind is to conceal or seem to conceal that which cannot be concealed. And so we have to go to some considerable efforts and measure to reveal what has never been hidden. And that's what we call practice. And so he circles, he stands, and Zhang Jing says, right, right. And the footnote says, for the moment, I believe half. Why only half? Is there something wrong? Is he leaving something out? Does it mean I don't believe in the other half? And, you know, I've talked about this many times, but this is part of the Zen tradition, and it's, which was part of the culture, as I understand it through my studies and talking to a lot of scholars, is that the language that was present in China, particularly high culture, which is where a lot of these particular teachings were sort of coming forth from, that language was a very, very conscious and sort of elaborate and highly cultured and developed aspect of life. And that alluding to things, not being explicit, not being direct, not being explanatory or sort of didactic, was held in very high regard. Why? Because when you're explicit, when I just explain something to you, it's sort of like, you know, you're hungry and the kitchen is, the larder is full and there's all this possibility and I make the whole meal and all you have to do is sit down and eat. But you don't even do that. I just ask you to open your mouth and I stick it in and I do this. Right, and I swallow. Right? And then I wash the dishes. Like, what's your part of this? So Zen's not like that. You cook the meal. You do the whole thing. And so the language is part of that. The language is inviting us in with traps set, right? So you can't just barge in thinking, oh, I got this, I know this, I understand this. We realize, I don't actually know, I don't understand. What? And in that, we have to lean in a little bit. We have to listen carefully because we realize they're not laying it all out. They just keep pointing. They keep pointing. They keep firing these shots. But what are you saying? They're clearly presenting something that is understood. They're reporting. They're speaking from a place that is clearly understood. And that is what has been passed down since the Buddha. If words have intrinsic meaning, if we believe they have intrinsic meaning, then write, as one teacher said, Zhang Jing said, write, write. And another teacher said, I say, what could be wrong? Another master said, write can affirm nothing, and wrong contains no real denier. Right and wrong have no master. Myriad virtues are ultimately one. And what he's saying is if we see something, we say that's right. If we examine that thing, we can't find right in that thing. It doesn't exist in that thing. If we see something, an action, and we think that's wrong, if we examine that action carefully, we don't see anything in it that is intrinsically wrong, right? That's something clearly that we are bringing to it. Necessarily, often, we have to know right and wrong. Buddhism is profoundly based in morality. How are we going to alleviate suffering if we don't know what is right and wrong? If we don't know what is causing suffering and alleviating suffering? But the moment that we endow something falsely with an intrinsic, absolute sense of right and wrong, as though it exists in the object or in the action or in the person, dogma is born. Something goes from being right in a way that can be skillful to being righteous in a way that now becomes like a weapon. And maybe we see a little bit of this going on around. And when that is not clearly understood, everything about human beings becomes dangerous. Our thoughts, our words, our very being, our actions, not because we are intrinsically dangerous, not because the words we speak or the thoughts we have are intrinsically dangerous. They're not. If we look at any of those, we will not find right or wrong intrinsically in those things. But that absolute nature, that empty nature that has no of its own being, exists within a relative world of right and wrong. And so how we work with those qualities, those actions, is where we create heaven and hell. You know, I was just listening to somebody talk about this seizure of all these classified documents from the former president, right? Which is, seems to be inarguably illegal, that those were taken. They don't belong to any president. They belong to the people, right? So just the taking of them was inarguably illegal. But the fact that the FBI went and seized them rightly and legally among many conservatives has become a defund the FBI, right? Have you seen that? Defund the FBI. Well, not long ago, there were those who were talking about defunding the police because of the shooting of unarmed Black Americans. And there was a hue and cry from the very same people. Same words. So when it helps me, then those words are good. When it doesn't help me, those words are bad. So they don't have intrinsic value, but if we just use them based on our desires, right, and they have no connection to what is actually true or what is actually helpful or skillful, and that is not even our intention, then they become like weapons, and we become dangerous. We manifest our capacity to destroy. So think about all of the profound attention the Buddha gave to thoughts and words and actions, right? Not just because he realized that that is our pathway to liberation, but because for the very same reason he realized that's how we create so much, all of the human misery in the world. And so when this master says, right and wrong have no master, this is a very profound medicine. And so then he goes on, Magu goes on to Nanquan, same thing. Goes in, circles the seat, shakes the staff, stands at attention. Now Nanquan says, wrong, wrong. The footnote says, I believe half of this too, for the moment. Why for the moment? What is he saying? Everything is passing by. To say, I believe half of this, suggests I believe half of this forever. That view is correct forever. I will always believe half of this because everything is fixed. And so he says, I believe half of this for the moment. I believe half of this because it is half true, because believing in half of it is in accord with things, because believing in half of it and for us to hear those words might be skillful. What does he mean for the moment? Now, we can understand this to be either just relativistic. It's like, what is right for you is right for you. It doesn't, you know, and that's it. And what is right for me is right for me, and that's it. And so who am I to say if what is right for you seems wrong to me and it is causing all kinds of harm? It's not my business because, you know, it's right for you. So that has nothing to do with Buddha Dharma. It's not that. But on the other hand, to say that it has fixed nature, absolute nature, that it is dogmatic, that we should attach to it, as though it does exist in things or people or actions, we don't need any more studies of that, what the results of that are. So what is the middle way? When the Buddha said, I teach the middle path, you know, don't think of that as just balance. Balance is good. But when the Buddha said the middle path, he was talking about a profound revolution in the way we see things. And so we could misunderstand this. Zhangqing says right, Nanquan says wrong. Everything is empty, you can't find wrong in anything, can't find right, to mean that nothing really matters, nothing means anything, everything is relative. These are just words. It's like when people write about koans, who I think have not practiced them, and say they're like puzzles. They're not puzzles. I mean, do we think these masters had nothing better to do? that they thought, I'm going to live forever, so let's just play some games. That's not really Buddhism's story. It's really, there's the opposite. Because everything is free of any fixed position, a bow, an arrow, a yumi, a yana, a target, a wall, a tree, cleaning a floor, walking, lying down, can be something that causes harm, can be an action that gives life. It can reveal the secret that has never been hidden. It can entangle us even deeper into our pain and confusion. When the Buddha talked about the four postures of practice, sitting, standing, walking, and lying down, they're not just postures of practice in which we can practice, but they're the postures in which doors are opened. Because each of those postures is a state in and of itself. Magu was manifesting several of them, walking, standing. There are a number of koans that focus on this notion, well, I mean, in a way they all do, but very explicitly on this notion of right and wrong. When Master Fayan, one day at the beginning of a Taisho, pointed to the blinds, and two students got up and raised up the blinds to let the light in, and Fayan said, one has it, and one doesn't. That's all he said. Master Zhaozhou went to one hermit and said, are you in? And the hermit raised their fist. Zhaozhou said, the water is so shallow here. I could never anchor a boat here. He goes to another hermit and says, are you in? Hermit raises the fist, just alike. And Zhaozhou said, the water is deep here. And the question is, why did Zhaozhou affirm one and not the other? Which one is right and which one is wrong? And so those koans are leading us right into that place where we get entangled. And so we're sitting and trying to figure out. And so typically the student will say, well, this student was distracted. They raised their fist, but they weren't really present to it, right? Or they weren't really meticulous in raising their fist. They were wrong. And the other hermit was attentive and present, fully awake. How do you know that? How do they know that? Right? That's not in the koan. We're not getting any information to that. All we know is this. And so part of the koan is face reality. Face what's in front of you. All you know is this. Don't project. Don't make stuff up and think it's true. Right? This is enough. That's what the koan is saying. This is all you need to know. But now you have to enter into it. To go beyond the sense of right and wrong. And so the koans are presenting that. This koan is presenting this because it's understood how entangled we get in that. So how are we going to disentangle? Not from a distance. We have to get caught in right and wrong and see, oh, I'm caught in right and wrong. Where is it? Is it in the fist? Is it in raising the blinds? Is it in my mind? How does it appear? How do I untie that knot? What is right and wrong? How do I manifest compassion and live in a world where there is good and evil? Without creating the very thing that I'm trying, the knot that I'm trying to untie, or the very suffering that I'm trying to alleviate. I read a book recently, Americana, by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, a Nigerian author, and she said, racism should never have happened, so you don't get a cookie for reducing it. Right? You don't get a reward. We don't get a reward for alleviating suffering. Right? We don't get a reward for realizing self-nature. Right? It's one of the reasons why in training, there's not a lot of, you know, we don't like have a board up. You know, with gold stars, you know, like in school, everybody's name, like who's the best practitioner of the month, right? Who gets a raise? Who gets a bonus? We don't really do that because that's the thing that we then start to practice to. What do I have to do to get that? What do I have to do to get recognition, to get affirmation? Now, of course, getting affirmation, encouragement can be extremely helpful, right? And so there is that. But it's done knowingly, it's done carefully, because that can be such a hook, right? That's that big, fat, juicy worm that we're looking for. And then we forget about what we really came for. We get about what we're actually trying to do, and we're just trying to get onto that, get a bite of that worm. From a Buddhist perspective, we might say that spiritual practice is really kind of our responsibility. Whatever form it takes, it's not that it has to be Buddhist, but some measure of taking responsibility for our lives is kind of our obligation in being alive, right? To do something good, to make something better, to not add to the confusion and chaos. Because we are partaking of all of this abundance, right? We there's sort of a cost of doing business here, right? Like, we have to take from this world in order to combust, all right? So what's the giving back part? What's that about? And so really, because if we think of it as kind of our luxury, you know, sort of like when everything else is done, then we practice. I think if we really understood how much influence we have, how we are affecting, changing our world, changing each other, we are clearly changing ourselves all the time. And how every thought and every word and every action has consequence. I think we would be a lot more careful, a lot more attentive, a lot more caring about how we manifest those wheels. And so Nan Kwan says to Magu, Zhang Jing said, right, why do you say wrong? What is he up to? Right? What is he looking for? Nan Kwan said, Zhang Jing is right, it's you who's wrong. This very thing, is something that is blown by the power of the wind. It inevitably disintegrates. What is this? So again, to enter into this, to be Magu, approaching both of these teachers, receiving that right, receiving that wrong, and really receiving it, now what? Where does that leave you? Where do you find yourself? Are you right or are you wrong? Because if you're right, you're just right until the next wrong comes along and you know it's coming. And if you're wrong, we may get so accustomed to that we never can even see the rights that come down. We don't even recognize them. Nan Kwan, in between both of these masters, went to see another teacher, didn't make it into the koan. He went to see the national teacher. And he asked the same question to the national teacher. And the national teacher said, since you are capable of such as this, what need is there to see me? Why are you here? If you understand this, then what are you doing? Why are you here? And Magu shook his staff again. And the national teacher said, basically, get out of here. He didn't want to mess with him. And then the commentary says, indeed, it was because it is hard to forget that which has become familiar, and he was used to getting the advantage, that Magu then went on to see Nan Kwan. And I thought that line just leaped out to me. It is because it's hard to forget things that become familiar, and we get used to having the advantage. Now, we could say the same. We get used to having the disadvantage. We just get used to the thing that happens again and again. And it's hard to forget it. And the way in which we remember it goes so much deeper than we can appreciate in the beginning. When we talk about identity, when we talk about identifying with, that's who I am, that the repetitiveness of that experience, of that affirmation, or that rejection, that reward, or that punishment, that success, or that failure, when it happens again and again, of course we're going to begin to wrap ourselves around that. That's what the world seems to be telling us. And then of course we're going to begin to think, that is me. That's who I am. So then it's going to be very hard when we begin practicing to forget that that's who I am. Because if that's who I am, what do you mean, forget it? It's like in the moment when somebody says something, we feel defensive and we begin to react as though we're under attack. And to just stop and ask the question, what is it that's being threatened here? You know, in all of our Beyond Fear of Differences work, when we discuss the identities that we create around race or gender or sexual orientation or faith or position, we speak of this in terms of identities, not to reify them. Oftentimes Buddhists say, why are we doing that? Isn't that just solidifying? They're already solidified. They are very solid. Almost very solid. So we discuss them so that we can see, oh, that's an identity, being white? I just thought was nothing. I didn't think that even existed. I see that being black or brown exists, but I never thought about being white exists. Why? Because I was trained. This is the standard. This is the normal. So I don't need to think about it. I don't need to see it as an identity, because it has been engineered so that I don't have to do that, which means I don't see the suffering that comes from that identity, that separates, that creates high and low, and that is taught to be endowed in the bodies of black, brown, and white people, and every hue. And so we have to bring our attention to it. It's like, why did the Buddha start with his teaching by saying life is dukkha? Why didn't he start by saying enlightenment is amazing? Let me tell you, it's just unbelievable. Right? But rather he said, life is suffering, disappointment, dissatisfaction, because that's not just our experience, but that's the identity, that's the self that has been created about that. That is the experience that the person, the student that the Buddha was speaking to has had over and over and over again and is trying to liberate themselves. He was talking to the ascetics that he had lived with. They are trying to liberate themselves from it through their ascetic practice. But by believing that there is someone that is suffering, the Buddha realized it will never be alleviated. Because if that is intrinsically who you are, that's who you are. That's why his realization that there is no self was his liberation and ours. And that's why when that identity gets challenged, it can be so devastating. You know, it's like the pushback, you know, as those who are trying to work towards equity, right? That we all belong, we all deserve a fair chance, we all deserve an equal share, right? That those who have been used to having a more than equal share, having all the advantage, see that as a complete loss. What do you mean, you want some of this? And it's not experienced as sharing, like as a white person, you know, to give up some of that advantage, some of that privilege, which doesn't really, it means just letting everybody have what there is to have. Letting everyone have what is good and not have what is not good. Or if there is necessary, not good, then let's all have that equally. But having been so accustomed to that advantage, when I feel someone asking for some equity, I can experience it as an absolute loss. Because the identity is so, it has become so familiarized with that, that I can't even conceive of it, and it just feels like a complete threat. And so to think about, just to observe, think about that as we observe the pushback of people, of all people from historically excluded groups and communities within our country, our community, who are not asking for revenge or retribution, but just equity. And how that is perceived as grounds for war. So identity is, it's not just a word. It's a living, dynamic experience that we have. And as long as we don't see it, that habit holds all the power. That's why, I mean, why when we're so conscious and we're so willful about wanting to change something, a pattern, and we just keep falling into it, keep falling into it, keep falling into it. There's something else going on. It's functioning at a deeper level, which means that's why we have to get deeper. We can't just have a new idea, a new ideology. We can't just have an open heart, although that's plenty good. But we actually have to go into the depths, the inner chamber, as Dogen spoke of it. And that's what this is, Cohen, is right and wrong. So get tangled up in right and wrong. Now, it's not abstract at all. Now, with that mind, with that meditative mind, with that mindfulness and concentration, examine it. What is right? When he says, right can affirm nothing. So in the moment when you have created right within you or wrong within you, right, pride within you or self-doubt within you, can you find the basis for that pride within you? Where does it exist? Bring it out. Touch it. Measure it. And that's why he says, when Nathmagu wants to know why, he said right, why do you say wrong? Zhajing is right, it's you who are wrong. He just builds another cage. Not because Magu is wrong, but because Magu has built a cage of wrong that he doesn't yet see, and so Nanquan builds another cage. So he can see that. And then he gives him a cookie. He gives him some warm milk and a cookie. He says, okay, look, this is something that can be blown away by the power of the wind. It inevitably disintegrates. He basically says, look, dude, right? This is not your true power. This is not something you can rely upon. Do you see that? So I wanted to end with a poem by Gary Snyder that I just read in the Tricycle that was nice. And I wanted to read it because I like it and because I think it relates to this. It's sort of speaking to what we create when we are caught in that realm of right and wrong, which is really a merciless, tyrannical kind of world. It's relentless. No matter where we find ourselves into it. And it's not all the same. So even if you're at the top of the heap, that's obviously not the same tyranny as when you're at the bottom. But it's still a tyranny. That's why the God realm in the Buddhism teaching of six realms, the God realm is still samsara, even though everything looks great and you've got everything you need, it's still a realm of suffering. Because the gods are relying on all of that stuff, just like Magu. So this is for Gary Snyder. He titled it, For the Children. The rising hills, the slopes of statistics lie before us, the steep climb of everything going up, up as we all go down. In the next century, or the one beyond that, they say, our valleys, pastures, we can meet there in peace if we make it. To climb these coming crests, one word to you and to your children, stay together. Learn the flowers and go light. Stay together. Learn the flowers. Yes. Study the wonder of the flower and go light.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.